Good morning, everybody. Welcome. I have a guest I'm so pleased to welcome back on the show with me this morning, Gene Polasinski. He's the Senior Vice President and Executive Director of the First Amendment Center, which is based right here in Nashville. We're so fortunate. And I'm so pleased to welcome Gene back. We're going to talk a little bit about the First Amendment and sort of what's been going on and why all of a sudden we seem to be reading so much about it. And it's never a bad time to revisit the First Amendment. So, Gene, welcome. Welcome back to the show. Glad to have you.
Thank you, Barbara. Glad to be with you.
Yeah. So I guess what really sort of piqued my interest in this topic, I mean, I'm always interested in it as a journalist, but just there seems to be a lot of dialogue around the First Amendment lately. And I'm kind of curious, is that something that's always out there and maybe now it's maybe finally making some headlines, or are we looking at sort of a historic moment where there's all of a sudden a lot of conversation about what the First Amendment really means?
Well, you know, there's kind of always a sort of industrial hum in the legal profession about the First Amendment.
Yes.
There are technical issues to be solved. There are issues like prisoners' rights and things that go along, but don't get a lot of attention. But I think thanks to everything from the Tea Party to Occupy movements,
right,
to a case called Citizens United that put campaign fundraising right into the fore just as we entered a presidential year, and some other issues that have to do with the always contentious religion in public schools, they all seem to be coming at the same time. And I think another factor, too, is that some years ago, it generally was whether you had a First Amendment right to do something or not. And what we're seeing now is very often First Amendment rights or other part of the Bill of Rights being pitted against each other. And I think those tend to make a little more headlines. The right of government officials to private speech versus having to have their meetings in public, for example. You know, 20 years ago we were fighting to open meetings.
Right.
That didn't capture the headlines the way it would a government official saying, I have a private right to talk to my fellow member of the council, which is going on in Texas right now. So the nature has changed a little bit. I think you're right, though. It's more, I think, more in the big headlines these days.
Yeah, and of course, as you mentioned, thanks to some of these movements that have been out there leading up to the presidential election, it's maybe held our feet to the fire a little bit to define those elements of the First Amendment that really mean something to us or that resonate with various groups.
You're right. I think, you know, we've had a lot of public discussion about the freedom of religion and free press and free speech, certainly. But the rights of assembly and petition, you know, they're known as the orphan freedoms. We don't often think about them. And yet, if you look at Tea Party and Occupy movements, for example, the right to assemble and the right to petition government for change are paramount. So they're an interesting kind of switch that those amendments that people rarely think about or can't even name really have become the stuff of today's headlines.
Yeah, it was funny you call them the orphan amendments, but you're right. And I remember when I was in journalism school and learning about the First Amendment, you don't really learn about that as much. Everyone looks at the sort of high profile, sexy, you know, freedom of speech as sort of the umbrella of everything.
Yeah, you tend to get in journalism school, which I went to as well, you get freedom of the press and then there are other freedoms.
Yes.
And they sort of all vaguely relate to freedom of speech, which is really freedom of press anyway, and you go back to that one freedom. But all five really depend on each other, including freedom of religion. You know, you need to be able to express your religion. You need to be able to assemble with others of like minds. So all those freedoms are really interrelated.
Right. And you know, it's interesting when you talk about freedom of religion, because that seems to be a really emotional issue for obvious reasons, but it seems that is cycling back around a lot more lately, and I know that there's a lot of headlines made around that particular freedom. What is that all about?
Well, you know, I think mainstream faiths have come into a period in which we're more diverse as a country than ever before, and they're feeling challenged by a lot of faiths that weren't mainstream. Within faith, beliefs are being challenged. People are writing and speaking and marching sometimes about those kinds of issues like gay marriage or even sometimes tenets of the faith. And so, you know, we have that combined with this larger discussion in our society, I guess, about Islam and Muslims in America. And you find a great deal more prejudice against Muslims than you might have 40 or 50 years ago when it was just considered, with all due respect, perhaps more of a curiosity than a threat.
Right.
But after 9/11, clearly, some people began to identify not just terrorists, but Islam as itself as a threat to America. And that's engendered a lot of discussions. You know, we found that in a recent survey we did, we do an annual survey called State of the First Amendment. A few years ago, we surveyed and asked if fringe faiths should receive the same kind of First Amendment protection that, that mainstream faiths do. And almost a third of Americans, 30%, said no.
Oh.
And you know, regardless of how you feel about that now, if you go back to 1791 when the amendment was first adopted, the fringe faiths at that time would have included Catholics and Baptists, the two largest
right.
faiths by enrollment in America today.
Right.
Because, you know, Baptists were considered sometimes illegal because they didn't go through state licensed ministers. They had a personal relationship with God. Each individual did.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Catholics were, deemed to have allegiance to the Pope in Rome, the Papist, other country. And so those faiths would never have grown, I think, to the presence they have in our society today had the First Amendment's protection not been extended or from the beginning included them. And so we tend to forget that today. We tend to look at what we have as sort of the settled issues. And, really a lot of faiths today that I think people have brought with them from their home countries or that people are investigating contribute to a larger religious health in this country. But I think people in mainstream faiths feel threatened. And as a result, they often will challenge what they see as an intrusion on their right to either be a majority in a particular place, to have their prayers said in public building, or their particular faith endorsed, if you will, by the local schools. And that's causing a lot more friction with people who now are large enough in numbers to say, no, wait a minute, we couldn't fight this before, but we're not going to stand for it right now. That's not what the First Amendment says.
Right, absolutely. I'm speaking with Gene Polasinski. He's Senior Vice President and Executive Director of the First Amendment Center, which we're lucky enough to have right here in Tennessee. So I'm able to get a hold of you when I really want to, and it's great. And we're talking about the First Amendment and some of the challenges that we're all facing now as we struggle to redefine what it means to us. And you bring up some really interesting points, Gene, about religion in particular, which seems to be a very hot button issue right now, and link it back to 9/11, which I think it appears, I guess, and for obviously it's touched a crisis off in this country, a crisis of faith in ourselves, in humanity, in other people's religions and faith. It's sort of challenged us in a lot of ways. Is this something that's, do you see this as something that's moving us forward in terms of our evolution as individuals, as Americans, or is it something that's maybe setting us back a bit?
Well, I think we're being challenged perhaps as never before, although there have been other periods,
sure,
where to really live up to what we say.
Mm-hmm.
If we really believe in the idea that all faiths have a right to exist in our country without government interference and without limitations, and we also believe no one faith should be favored by the government, roughly up until about 1920 in this country, if you were talking about religion in America, religion and institutions, religions were favored, you were really talking about Protestant faiths.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1920s, Catholics began to exert political pressure because their numbers had swelled to the point that they could elect public officials. And then as we moved from the 1920s on, the country became very diverse in terms of faiths. And so I think in a way, as never before, being challenged to really say, if you believe those credos from the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, if you believe what the First Amendment says, that Congress shall make no law establishing or preventing the free exercise of religion, now we have to live up to that. And if you've been in kind of a most favored status, that hurts. I understand why people are upset because if you're going to hand out a Bible in a public school in this country, probably there was going to be no serious objection. Frankly, 50 or 80 years ago, no court was probably going to stop that. It was going to be the King James version of the Bible. And there was a sort of de facto acknowledgement that that's the right faith. I had a woman call me one time, an older woman a few years ago, called me to correct me on something I had written. And I was talking about freedom of religion. And she said, young man, I'm surprised in your job that you don't know that, yes, all those other faiths can be in America, and they have a perfect right to be wrong. But then went on to lecture me on why this is a Christian country. And I tried to explain to her, that's not quite it. We have been predominantly a Christian country for a long time. But there's nothing in the Constitution or the First Amendment endorsing Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only place religion is mentioned is in Article 6, where it says you can't have a religious test for public office.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it certainly doesn't denigrate Christians, and I wouldn't want to do that, it does not provide that sort of most favored status either. And when you've had it, even if it's been not legal, but just acknowledged. I think it's a hard thing to give up, and I think that's part of the reason we're starting to see this become such a bitter battle. Is it, you know, maybe sometimes losing what you have is harder than ever having it all.
Sure, and of course, change is always hard. What are some of the other big challenges? I mean, we've touched on religion a great deal, and that seems to be a very hot button issue. What are some of the other big challenges to the First Amendment that are kind of out there that you're dealing with?
Well, across a range of issues, technology. The internet has just spawned an entirely new discussion about free speech, and frankly, even assembling virtual communities and the right of petition. It's impacted the way we look at public documents. We used to live in a sort of what we used to call practical obscurity.
Yeah.
You know, your land transfer, your mortgage was on file at the courthouse. Nobody really looked at it except a few people who were in the business. Now, you can go online and look up what your neighbor paid for their house.
All kinds of stuff, yeah.
And autopsy results and gun registration records, and that's making a lot of people nervous. So the internet is a huge factor in changing the discussion around the First Amendment. And then student rights, you know, we've moved from an era in which we said students don't leave their rights at the schoolhouse door to being very concerned about violence in schools, drugs in schools, and we're beginning to retreat from that dramatic and I think correct position that students have all the rights that adults do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another area of contention. And then generally free speech, you know, again, somewhat related to the web, but we have people now able to reach much larger audiences with messages that some people or many people don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pressure there to, you know, can we have free speech for everybody except them, you know,
right,
because they don't say the right thing or they have a message, frankly, that's maybe offensive to 99% of us.
Right.
The Westboro Baptist Church, which goes around and demonstrates at military funerals. Most Americans think that's awful. Do we have to permit it? I think the Supreme Court correctly said we do.
Mm-hmm.
If we live in a society with free speech, we can't punish people for being effective in the way they get their message across. We can regulate sort of time, place, and manner.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have a right to speak at a place when people are going to notice them, even if that notice comes, I think, with an attendant sick feeling in your stomach.
Right.
Which it does to me.
Right. And, of course, I guess that's sort of part of it. You can't have, you can't pick, cherry pick what part of the First Amendment you're going to, you know, apply to or adhere to. It's kind of, you know, it's all of it. And some of it makes you uncomfortable, I guess. But we have to just accept that that's part of the freedom.
Well, you know, there was a justice of the Supreme Court in the 1940s who really spoke about that and said, in effect, what I call the contrarian theory, which is you need to hear messages you don't like,
yes,
views you oppose,
yes,
if only to be better prepared to oppose them.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's an element of that is I need to hear that. And I think one thing today, again, going back to the web, when we set up the apps or if we only have the websites we really think do a good job because they basically agree with me, we don't hear those other voices, and I think sometimes when we then hear them for the first time, we're dramatically upset, but we're also not really prepared for their point of view or their argument.
Right.
So I think it behooves all of us to really embrace the idea of the First Amendment, which is the marketplace of ideas, and there are always going to be ideas you don't like. Maybe you can take bits and pieces of ideas you don't like and craft an idea you do like.
Mm-hmm.
But just hearing from the people who are echoing you doesn't move things forward, and yet, you know, we've become very comfortable as a society. We would like to ban anything that doesn't, you know, sort of give us a warm and fuzzy feeling, and that's really not how the world works.
Right, absolutely. I'm speaking with Gene Polasinski. He's Senior Vice President and Executive Director of the First Amendment Center, and talking a lot about what the First Amendment really means to us. And Gene, you touched kind of lightly on the Supreme Court and some of the issues it's been grappling with. Where do you think the court's headed? It's going to be kind of interesting. It's a very interesting mixed bag there. How do you think they're doing and where do you think they're going?
Well, in terms of the First Amendment, they're not that predictable in some ways.
Yeah.
I think if you're a student or a prisoner, forget it. they're not endorsing your rights in any way.
Right.
And they're very intent, I think, on protecting commercial speech and speeches where we have a choice. So that if it's not something that's sort of rammed down our throats, they're inclined to allow it to go on because we can choose to see it or not, or buy it or not, or mm-hmm. be exposed to it or not. And that, beyond that, it's a little hard to determine what direction the court is going. And, you know, I do think that they have had some opinions that are ringing endorsements of free speech. I mentioned the Westboro Baptist decision. Also Citizens United, which opened up corporate spending in elections. And that, you know, didn't change our system of elections. Some people say it will influence it dramatically by providing lots of money that wasn't going to be spent before. This was Citizens United said corporations and unions and others can spend their own money directly on elections. They still can't contribute to a candidate, but they can spend money in support or opposition. And they used to be limited by in their ability to do that, or forbidden in some cases. Well, I think the solution there isn't to restrain the speech. It's to make the speech more transparent. If you want to give money to a candidate, I think your contribution should be known within 24 hours. You know, you and I can write a check across the country, and within 24 hours, electronically, it shows up, debited in our account, and I can get a little picture in my bank of that check.
Right.
Well, why should I wait 3 to 6 months to find out who contributed to Barack Obama or Mitt Romney or a congressional candidate or, frankly, Carl Dean for mayor or his opponent? You know, I think transparency goes a long way. And then you know whether those grassroots campaigns are, an old joke, they're real grass or transplanted sod. you know, and whether it's a billionaire giving all but $10 to a candidate, you know. And that will tell you more about the candidate than maybe anything else. So I think transparency would be the solution. The trick there is, of course, to get legislators to enact those rules regulating themselves.
Right. Good luck. Boy, it's such a packed topic, and obviously, you know, we have limited time, and it goes on and on, which is why we have a whole First Amendment Center. If people want to get more information about the First Amendment, and you guys have a website, what is that?
It's cleverly named firstamendmentcenter.org.
Love it.
I think you can go there and find just about every issue. You know, we are a nonpartisan group. We don't lobby. We don't litigate. We don't fund litigation. We see our job to educate. So you'll find some views that I think surprise people. I remember being on an NRA talk show, National Rifle Association talk show on radio, and a guy was just amazed I would come on. And I said, well, you know, why not? The First Amendment protects everybody.
Right.
And so you'll find, I think, a balanced view on our – you'll find some strong views, but you'll find a balanced view on our website.
Right. And how wonderful to have that resource available to us. And because it is something that we all struggle with, and I think – you know, it's very hard to define. It's very hard to understand. And I guess that's sort of the point, is that as our world evolves, the Constitution is a living document, and it evolves too. And which means we do have to constantly have that battle with ourselves. So so grateful that you guys are there and able to provide some of those resources. I'm so happy that we were able to speak about this today. I've been speaking with Gene Polasinski. He's the Senior Vice President and Executive Director of the First Amendment Center. And if you want more information or resources, go to firstamendmentcenter.org, and you can get all kinds of great information and see what they're all about and what we're all about. So, Gene, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, a pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.